My name is Connor Coughlin, and I'm the Global Head of Marketing here at Finergo, and I'll be your host for today's on-demand webinar. In today's webinar, we'll be doing a review of our research analysis over the last decade. We'll be introducing you to our esteemed panelists from our regulatory and compliance team. We'll be updating you about the live delegate poll findings, and then we'll be moving on to our questions and answers and providing you with as much information and assistance as we can.
Thanks, Connor. So my name is Laura Glenn. I'm the Director of Global Regulatory Compliance here in Finergo, managing the regulatory analysis and validating the regulatory roadmap in conjunction with our community of client banks.
My name is Rachel Woolley. I work in the regulatory practice as a regulatory consultant, primarily focused on anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing laws, regulations, and research. And we'll be participating actually in the MENA webinar that Connor mentioned as well.
Fantastic. So I hope you'll all agree we're in very good company. And but Laura and Rachel have been heavily involved in the analysis behind our recent updates and the interactive infographic you'll have seen and the associated blogs and outputs. But we're now going to go through the research. As I said, we'll take it by both globally and then in relation to regional imperatives. So Laura, over to you for the global overview.
Thanks, Connor. So we've just some intro stats set out here. So 26 billion, the total amount levied in fines against financial institutions since 2008. 11.52 billion levied in 2015 alone. That was the most punitive year that we identified during our research. 8.9 billion, the highest single instance of a fine levied by the US DOJ, who were the most active regulator according to our research. Overall, the US have been the most prolific, so issuing 90% of the total amount by dollar amount of fines globally, followed by the Netherlands, Australia, and finally the UK. So there's certainly some interesting trends emerging from the analysis. So while none of the fines are surprising in their own right, it's really when you look at the total amount over the decade and that it certainly packs a punch when you're considering it in totality. It's clear from the research that global regulators are increasingly putting financial institutions, AML and KYC procedures, policies, systems and controls under the microscope. In terms of future trends, one thing that is really emerging is even where a firm has very robust systems, robust controls, but there isn't a strong compliance culture within the firm, they're not going to withstand the increasing regulatory scrutiny in that area.
Yeah, and I think I suppose it's interesting to note as well is that the majority of fines that have been issued are as a result of administrative failings as opposed to actual instances of money laundering and terrorist financing being facilitated. But I suppose the impact of allowing weak controls to continue within a financial institution essentially facilitates or creates loopholes for the exploitation of weakened systems. So that's, I suppose, something that we've observed throughout the analysis is that although it's not specific instances of money laundering and terrorist financing, it is essentially facilitating or creating ways for that to occur.
Yeah, I think another interesting trend is when you see who the most active regulators are in this space, it is the regulators who have the more defined requirements, more prescriptive guidance. So there is a higher standard to be measured against. Countries that don't have as prescriptive guidance, it's harder to hold those institutions to as high a threshold.
Yeah, and I think that's probably something that we'll see as we move into the regional focus as well, is the difference in approach in supervisory and regulatory activity is how hands-on certain supervisors and regulators actually are and the result of that and impact of that on the financial institutions under supervision.
Okay, very certainly informative and absolutely certainly fantastic in relation to what's happening on a macro perspective. But could I just encourage you to go a little deeper? And I know we're going to come into regional specific focuses, but if you could just talk about two areas. So I think one, which is of interest, and we've seen inquiries, you know, can you give any kind of forward-looking perspective on, you know, what could we expect from an AML and sanctions enforcement perspective over the next few years? And perhaps you'd both like to respond on that. And then from a global perspective, and it's clear, and I know we're going to come on to the United States in due course, but why are domestic branches of foreign banks being fined more in the US than their domestic counterparts? Is there a particular reason for that, and what's driving that? And I know that's two questions, but perhaps let's take the what to expect going forward first, and then if we could just touch on, you know, why are domestic branches of foreign banks being fined more by US competent authorities than their domestic peers?
So I'll pick up the first question, Conor, just in relation to forward looking and what we can expect from AML and sanctions enforcement in the next few years. So I think we can largely expect that regulatory activity will continue globally. I think what we're starting to see is that more and more regulators are moving towards a principles-based approach. And some regulators indeed are actually looking at being more engaged in the process as opposed to undertaking what you might consider a checklist approach. So in particular, Japan, the FSA in Japan has outlined plans to adopt such an approach. So they've actually published reports on how they expect to achieve that and how they see their supervisory activities evolving over the next few years, so that it is a more collaborative process as opposed to essentially a backward-looking review and checklist engagement. I think in terms of the fine activities and the impact of the penalties that are being issued, we expect that we may start to see a number of countries and regions following in the footsteps of the US regulators, certainly in terms of the size of the penalties that are being issued. We've started to see that, I suppose, in terms of the Netherlands and Australia, who both this year have issued record-breaking fines. So we suspect that that might be a trend that's expected to continue going forward as well.
Yeah, I think as well, just to touch on one of the earlier points I mentioned, culture and conduct are really two emerging trends, and they've been discussed both in speeches as well as published memorandums by various regulators. So locally here in Ireland, a recent speech by the Central Bank of Ireland really covered culture and conduct quite extensively, talking about setting the tone from the top and how robust systems in their own right aren't going to be deterrent unless that culture is embedded within the organization. The HKMA, March of last year, March 2017, issued a memo to all authorized institutions setting out guidance in terms of how culture should be adopted within an organization and how it should be measured across governance incentive systems, so linking it to bonus and performance, as well as feedback loops. The Royal Commission into Banking in Australia has had a large focus on conduct and culture as well. And then globally, there has been a move towards the senior manager responsibility, and we're seeing that in a number of jurisdictions. So within the UK, within Singapore and movements in Hong Kong, there's also discussions locally here in Ireland about moving towards that type of regime. And it's one that I think is going to be widespread across many global financial centres. And that's really some of the feedback that's come back through the analysis, I think. So whether these monetary fines go far enough, are they really hitting the banks hard enough, or is there a need to move towards this responsibility at an individual level?
Okay, that certainly helps clarify what are those kind of macro themes and patterns, and what could we expect. But I suppose maybe now we'll move into the regional kind of focuses. So Laura, would you mind walking us through?
Sorry, Conor, there was your second question that I hadn't come back to yet. So that was around the foreign branches being fined more.
Sure.
Within. Yes. So I suppose this is somewhat subjective, but some of the thoughts that we had as we were going through this is there are a number of contributory factors here. So it may be that these farm branches are being staffed by expats who may not be as familiar with US rules and regulations. Equally, they could be brand new entities. There may not be any type of operating history. They haven't yet developed any relationships with stakeholders either across the industry or within the regulations themselves. One of the key findings that had come out from an APAC find, this was more in the European perspective, but I think the message translates. And it really reiterates some of the points I've called out there, where they found that the bank had been staffed by seconded staff who weren't familiar with the rules, regulations, and regulatory customs within the UK. And I think that's something that has come out in the analysis that we've looked at, but it is somewhat subjective. But finally, it is very important to note that from a supervisory and examination perspective, domestic branches are going to be subject to the exact same regulatory priorities and examinations. They aren't being measured to a stricter threshold by any means. It's just there may be some peripheral circumstances that can impact the type of fines or the type of exams that are being handed out.
Well, thank you, and apologies again. I should have noted whether a response has been given to the question I've raised myself. Well, perhaps now we can move to the US, and Laura, if you want to walk us through the regional specifics.
Great, thanks, Connor. So as I touched on earlier, the US are the highest issuer of AML and sanctions fines globally, and we've just included some averages here on the slide, so an average of 195 million across the top 11 regulators. Sanctions related penalties being the highest category, accounting for 44% of fines. And again, as we referenced earlier, 2015 was the most punitive year, so over 11 billion in fines issued. And then just some interesting points to note. So EU headquartered banks have been fined a total of 18 billion. And the APAC headquartered firms a total of 1.3 billion. So that really feeds into the question that you had just asked, Connor, about why these foreign branches are being fined more than their US counterparts. The figure that we had touched on earlier was that the US is amounting for 91% of all fines by dollar amount. So within the research for the North American region, we have included analysis across 14 featured regulators across four countries, so the US, Canada, Bermuda, and Mexico. So just touching on US here, but within the paper that will be circulated to any registered delegates, you will see analysis from the other regions. The peak fines for the period for the US then were between the years 2012 to 2015. 12.2 billion was levied on six institutions by the DOJ, and this accounts for over 50% of the total fine amounts over the 10-year period. So that's really where the hive of activity was in that period. And just of note, within the overall North American region and Canada, there was some interesting findings. They levied their first ever fine in 2016 for transaction reporting failures. There was circa $1 million Canadian dollars levied for that fine. And that particular bank was also the first within Canada to be penalized under expanded anti-money laundering rules. What is quite interesting, I think, within that region, FinTrack customarily keep fines and enforcements confidential. And over 95 published fines over that period, only 40 were named. So there was some industry pushback that this was somewhat unequal and an unlevel playing field where some banks were being held out and accounted for publicly, and other banks' details were allowed to be shrouded in somewhat mystery and confidentiality. Okay, so with that, I'm going to pass you over to Rachel, and she'll bring us through the EMEA analysis.
Yeah, so if we look then at the European analysis and the figures that are being quoted, so it's not quite at the US level, but I suppose across the 17 regulators and 15 countries as part of the analysis, a total of 1.7 billion has been issued in fines in the last 10 years. the largest fine of we've seen is actually one that came about this year. So that was issued by the Dutch authorities for 903 million. That was essentially issued as a result of a lack of or insufficient client due diligence and insufficient suspicious transaction investigations. So the failures, I suppose, by the bank that was issued with that penalty, it was highlighted that their failures, I suppose, existed from 2010 to 2016, which is, I suppose, one of the factors that contributes to the size of the fines that are issued. They often correlate somewhat to the number of instances, but also the length of time that the instances are allowed to continue. So just in terms of stats that are on the slide itself, so as I mentioned, there's 17 regulators across 15 countries that are included in the analysis, and the 1.7 billion essentially accounts for 7% of the AML fines that have been issued globally. This is accounted for by a total of 83 fines that were issued. And as we mentioned, although 2015 was a record year globally, 2018 from a European perspective has been the record year, obviously with that 903 million fine that was issued earlier in the year. In terms of the reason for the fine, so it's similar to the US trend. So AML violations even accounts for 89% of the total fines that were issued. And I suppose something that I find somewhat interesting in terms of the AML fines is just the difference, I suppose, in terms of the fines that are actually issued versus the fines that are received. So if we consider, obviously, and I know Laura's touched on this point already, in terms of the US regulators focusing on European headquartered banks and indeed other headquartered banks, so for instance in MENA and also APAC. So just some additional statistics, I suppose, from a European perspective, is if we look at some of the what you might consider the biggest financial centres across Europe. So, for instance, Switzerland has issued 51 million in fines, but has received 675 million. France has also issued 114 million and received 10 billion in fines, so quite a staggering amount there. Germany has issued 44 million and received a total of 2.1 billion. And then in Luxembourg, they've issued 14 million and received 152 million, excuse me. So I suppose it's just quite an interesting comparison when you consider that you would expect, I suppose, that the European supervisors would have more of an impact on their own banks or their own headquartered banks, as opposed to say, for instance, US regulators. But that's the level of fines that we're looking at, I suppose, that are coming out of the US. Just some other quick statistics, and I suppose from an EU perspective, is that half of the top 10 global issuers are actually coming out of the EU. So in terms of the individual monetary amounts, we're starting to see quite a lot or more instances, certainly, of the higher, more staggering fines, if you like. And then just finally, then I suppose from an EU perspective, is if we look at the actual activity that's undertaken by the EU regulators, the UK is the most active regulator and accounts for 30% of the AML fines and has issued, I think it's 6 of the top 10 fines that were issued across Europe as well. So there's some interesting statistics there, I suppose, from an EU perspective.
And Rachel, could I just ask a few queries in relation to you know, what's driving the kind of EU agenda, and I don't know if there's anything you could talk around the never-ending AML directives, but the 4th, 5th and 6th. And then you touched just briefly there on the UK, but could you give some clarity as to, like, why are they the biggest issuer of AML fines? So what's driving that? But maybe if you could start with the EU perspective around the 4th, 5th and 6th, and what can we kind of expect to see? And then if you could just take a moment and talk about, maybe Laura, if you take a moment and talk about why the UK is the largest issuer of AML fines within Europe.
Yeah, so I can start, I suppose, with the landscape across the EU in terms of how things have evolved over the last 10 years. So we're, as you mentioned, we're still tracking the 4th directive. We're talking about the 5th directive, and now the 6th directive is on the horizon as well. So We still have some member states across the EU that are yet to transpose the fourth directive, yet we now are expected to start considering the impact of the sixth directive. So if we just look, I suppose, at the fourth one, so what was introduced as part of the fourth AML directive is a greater emphasis on the implementation of a risk-based approach, which we've touched on. And that's, I suppose, in an effort to address the risk of money laundering and terrorist financing. So I suppose typically what you would have seen prior to the fourth directive is a number of countries would have almost adopted a blanket approach in terms of their due diligence. So in a lot of cases, enhanced due diligence might have been applied to what would typically be considered higher risk countries, whereas now the requirement is to take a more, I suppose, overall approach to the client rather than focusing specifically on geography. And then other things that we started to see as part of the fourth directive is a focus on beneficial ownership transparency. So obviously in the last 10 years, we've had the Panama Papers and other issues, I suppose, that have indicated a requirement to be more transparent in terms of the beneficial ownership regimes that we see across the globe. So the fifth directive then, I suppose, further enhanced that, and member states across the EU are required to establish national registers, which will see the collection and maintenance, I suppose, of beneficial ownership of companies within each of the member states across Europe. So that will obviously have, I suppose, an impact and, you know, be able to provide financial institutions and indeed authorities and relevant parties with a legitimate interest to access that information. They'll obviously have a clearer understanding of who owns these companies and who controls these companies, and in essence, for what purpose that might be. And then if we look forward then to the sixth directive, some of the proposed amendments that we're starting to see, so they would be in relation, I suppose, to criminal law offences. So the proposals there are looking at increasing penalties for money laundering offences and extending the criminal liability to include organisations. And I know Laura's touched on this earlier as well, as in terms of individual accountability. So one of the proposals as part of the sixth directive, which is still in draft form, so it, you know, certainly not committed to, but certainly something to consider, is that where an individual is responsible for an organisation that would essentially now be in scope for criminal liability, if it's found that they're if there was insufficient supervision or control over employee activities which subsequently enabled money laundering offences, then those individuals will be held liable and potentially prosecuted under the provisions of the sixth AML directive. So I suppose that's how much things have changed and evolved just in the last 10 years from an EU perspective. So there's been a lot, I suppose, of new regulations that financial institutions are expected to keep on top of. And that's just considering the AML space. So there's obviously other regulations that have been brought in the last 10 years as well.
Okay. And then Laura, your thoughts on from a UK perspective, why are they issuing so many fines?
So I don't think it's any real surprise that the UK are the biggest issuer of AML fines, given the size of the UK market and given the central role that the UK has taken pre-Brexit in terms of formulation and progressing EU legislative agendas. I think another interesting point to bear in mind is the legislative framework in Europe, so the notion of regulations versus directives, and how the AML directive, as a directive, does need to be transposed into national law. So that means there can be up to 28 national flavours of a particular item, such as the current four MLD. And in the UK, this is really supplemented by the JMLSG guidance, so the recognised industry best practice, highly prescriptive. So when that prescriptive guidance is there, and the central role that the UK has been playing on the European stage, coupled with the size of the markets and the number of businesses operating from London, really the central hub of financial activity in Europe up to now, I don't think it's any surprise that they are the most active regulator. I think what is also interesting and very timely is the, I won't quite say leaks, I'll say the advanced quotes that we have come across from the FATF evaluation of the UK, which is due out in December, and it's from what we've heard and what has been published unofficially to date is that the UK has been deemed to have an overwhelmingly effective regime, rating high in two outcomes, substantial in several others, and not achieving a low rating across any. So that's really, I suppose, cementing the reputation that the UK has across the AML landscape.
Okay, thank you. Certainly very helpful. And as you said, the size of the market seems to be a part of the reasoning and obviously the commitment to regulation and market supervision. So, okay, maybe we could move to another region and go to APAC. And Laura, back to you, I'm afraid. It's certainly a very important region and obviously a very diverse one, and certainly from our own company's perspective, bastions of development and innovation from a RegTech perspective. But could you walk us through what the trends and patterns across APAC are?
Yeah, absolutely. So from a RegTech perspective, APAC is a very interesting region. So for a relatively small region, it's home to over 40 regulators who have differing interpretations and nuanced legislative requirements, so making it one of the most complex jurisdictions in terms of managing regulatory compliance. It's certainly something that we've seen, particularly within the area of UBO, beneficial ownership. So it's where there's been the most degree of change over the last few years, and that's something that banks can grapple with to keep up with that change. As certain countries, so such as the Philippines, are prone to publishing updated circulars without a lot of advance notice. And over the last 2 years, we've seen a huge degree of change across the requirements within that area. Even as recently as last week, Hong Kong HKMA published an updated circular only last Friday, which is going to take effect on the 1st of November. So it's really not allowing banks very much lead in time to comply with any changes. So in terms of the overall fines, $609 million levied over the last 10 years. However, 88% of this is attributed to a single fine, and echoing Rachel's earlier sentiments, while 2015 may have been the busiest from a US perspective, within APAC, 2018 was certainly the year that took dominance within the APAC region. So that single fine accounting for 88% of the overall amount over the past 10 years, issued against one institution relating to sustained behavior over a three-year period. And in terms of other countries of interest then, so the Philippines, I think, is an interesting case study. So 21.3 million levied in fines. This accounts for only one fine, and that was a significant cyber heist. Following that, new rules were enacted by the Philippines. India is another interesting region. So the highest number of fines, 34 since 2012, but only the fifth in terms of monetary value, with fines totaling 11 million across the period. So in terms of the overall trends, AML violations are the key trend, and that's what we're seeing right across the regulators that we analyzed during the time period. So across AUSTRAC, the Central Bank in the Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore featuring several times, South Korea and Hong Kong. So within the white paper that is going to be sent out, we have given a breakdown of the top 10 fines that were levied across that period by those regulators.
Okay, well, certainly a very diverse and certain very divergent perspective. So, I mean, could we go a little more into this from an Asia Pac perspective? I suppose you've already addressed the trends, but you've mentioned obviously the record AML fine for the region. But if you think about the financial centres across APAC, do you think that we're going to see any, you know, pattern or particular enforcement activity or trend? Is there anything that you're envisaging that we could expect to see happening in the near future?
So I think, again, it's probably coming back to the culture element. So it's on MAS's supervisory priorities for this year. HKMA had published the circular last year, and we have the ongoing Royal Commission in Australia, the interim report having just come out a couple of weeks ago. And the notion of senior manager or senior executive responsibility really coming through. And I think that's the commentary and from anyone that we surveyed as part of this analysis as well. Through any of our community-led discussions, we've also been running some benchmarking exercises for CDD programs across the region. So we've had some very interesting discussions on this topic. So whether the fines are punitive enough, and that's really what's driving the notion of the individual accountability and how that's going to manifest itself. So I think certainly the memorandum that the HKMA had published last year, so in their guidance saying that this should be tied to performance, the notion of culture being tied to performance and conduct, and looking, taking a more holistic view and setting the tone from the top, ensuring it's embedded. I think that's going to be challenging from a regulatory perspective, though. So for culture, it's not tangible. So how is that embedded in an organization, firstly? So that's the challenge for the organization. But for the regulator, how do they then test that? How can they fully tell if culture is there flowing throughout every part of the organization?
I think that's probably why it's interesting actually to see Japan publish a report on how they envisage their supervisory approach and how they're seeing certainly want to engage in a more meaningful engagements with the banks that they supervise, rather than undertaking a checklist style review and subsequently issuing fines. So obviously the primary goal of financial regulation is to ensure that the financial system, certainly from an AML and terrorist financing perspective, is that it's not abused for criminal or for financing criminal activities. So I think when supervisors are actually actively engaging with the banks that they're overseeing, as opposed to, you know, later in the day issuing fines as a result of previous issues, that we actually probably have a more meaningful discussion with the regulators as opposed to just not complying with them.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we've seen coming out of Australia as well. So AUSTRAC only in the last week or so had published their approach to regulation. I think just being quite transparent with the industry, even calling out within that they see the entities that they're supervising as partners, and there should be a degree of collaboration. So both between AUSTRAC and the reporting entities, as well as AUSTRAC and international FIUs that they're in turn sharing information with. So there is definitely a move towards transparency, openness, and I think that paper was very well received. So this is how we're set up. This is what our culture is from an examination perspective. This is how we want to work with you. And by working together, we're going to really make strides towards mitigating and managing financial crime in our region.
Okay, well, certainly it's a very varied region and the responses and the different regulators and how they're engaging, but certainly some significant highlights in relation to what's happening in Japan and Australia and effectively across the region as a whole. So maybe we should move now on to MENA, but I would just like to, before we start on that, just to reiterate, there's been a number of questions about the proceedings from today. We are going to issue out the link for the on-demand recording. Most likely, I can't see why we wouldn't distribute a PDF version of the PowerPoint itself. However, I'm sure you can appreciate that if you got the PowerPoint slides on their own, a lot of the minutiae that we're discussing today won't be apparent. So we'll send out both to all registered delegates in due course. So back to you, Rachel, if you want to walk through MENA and what's happening in the region and the kind of trends that you're seeing. And there are a number of points that we could probably go deeper into, and then we'll open up to the questions. And again, to our delegates, if you have a specific question, query or comment, please use the chat icon in your upper right hand corner if you are logged into Citrix. If you're not logged into Citrix, you can reach out to us via info@finergo.com after this webinar, and we'll endeavor to come back to you. But over to you, Rachel.
Thanks, Connor. So just looking at the MENA region then, so we can see that the total fines that's been issued over the last 10 years is 9.5 million. So all of these are attributed to the Dubai Financial Services Authority, which is the most active regulator in the region. But again, as we touched on earlier, the comparison then versus fines that have been received by the region, so where the DFSA has issued 9.5 million, the total number of fines received across the MENA countries is 10.69 million. So yet again, we're seeing the banks, I suppose, with foreign operations receiving more regulatory penalties than their own regulators are issuing, although the numbers are almost aligned, I suppose. So just in terms of the MENA region in general, so what we're kind of expecting to see over the coming months and years, indeed, is just in relation to the AML legislation that exists in some of the countries. So some of it, I suppose, is quite outdated, you could say. And what we do expect to see going forward is, as some of those countries fall due for their FATF mutual evaluations, we can expect, I suppose, an increase in regulatory activity to ensure that any potential weaknesses in AML regimes and frameworks are closed ahead of time, before essentially FATF arrives to assess them. So recently we've seen the publication of the report for Saudi Arabia, which is currently in the process of pitching to become a full member of FATF as opposed to an observer, which it currently is. And we also saw the publication of the Bahrain mutual evaluation report. So that's, I suppose, a lengthy process where FATF essentially undertakes a review of the AML framework and regime that exists within the country. So typically you see an increase in activity ahead of that visit. So essentially that's what we'll be keeping an eye on across the MENA region over the coming months and years. Just in terms then, I suppose, of the ongoing activity in the region. So as I said, we've had a couple of reports that have been published by FATF. Saudi Arabia, I suppose, in terms of their sanctions, so we haven't actually seen any AML fines, certainly as part of the analysis. But what has been called out, I suppose, by FATF is that they have, I suppose, an established legal framework and coordination process to monitor UN financial sanctions to which they're subject. But what they have been, I suppose, called out on is that they're not conducting or they don't have sufficient resources really to effectively investigate and prosecute individuals involved in larger scale or professional money laundering activity. I suppose something to consider there is that's on a regional level national level, I suppose, as opposed to financial institution level. So what we need to consider there is what steps are being taken by the financial institutions in Saudi Arabia. But it's certainly something that we, I suppose, are interested in seeing as and when each of the countries falls due for their evaluations, because it's usually a good insight as to how business is conducted across the region when you consider the FATF evaluation.
Okay. Would you mind... Well, I suppose there's a number of questions and you touched on them, but and I know we're going to be having a webinar in due course kind of in greater detail on MENA and the evolution that's taking place there, both from a digitization perspective and obviously the trends that are impacting financial institutions across the region. But why do you think, and I know you've touched on it in some areas, why do you think there's an increased scrutiny or increased regulatory scrutiny now taking place? And can you, if you had a crystal ball, what do you think is likely to be the case in the next few years from a regulatory perspective? How do you think things are going to play out?
I think it's probably worth considering that the traditional assumption for a lot of the countries in the Middle East is that essentially they're perceived to have a light touch regulatory environment. So that may be the reason why there's such, I suppose, involvement from international regulators in terms of the fines that are being issued. And I suppose you could say that really for each of the regions that we've considered today. But I think as the Middle East progresses and continues to update, so certainly in specific countries where the AML laws haven't been reviewed or updated in quite some time, that as that occurs, so when the legislation is updated, and then typically what tends to happen is that regulatory activity increases shortly after the update of legislation. And then that's when you start to see, I suppose, the more regulations that exist, the more opportunities there are for regulations to be violated or for instances of non-compliance to emerge. So it may be the case that we start to see an increase in penalties being issued in the region. But I think, as we've kind of touched on before, a lot of countries globally are starting to move towards the principles-based and risk-based approach to regulatory supervision. So it may actually be the case, and I suppose what we would hope to see is that you have a model where there's ongoing and active involvement between the regulators and the financial institutions operating even in the countries, so that in a way acts as a mitigant to future money laundering and terrorist financing risks. So we would hope that would be the case, as opposed to the traditional checklist style supervision.
I think it's interesting as well for me. So even though they're seen to have a lighter touch regulatory approach in some areas, you then have the DFSA who have, now the Philippines have scaled back in their beneficial ownership thresholds. DFSA is one of the strictest in the world at 5%. So it's a region of contrast.
Yeah, and that's something that we saw. So just some other analysis that we conducted in terms of the introduction of beneficial ownership registers. So, and this, I suppose, points back to the comment with regards to the UK generally being ahead of the curve with a lot of this, the requirements that are introduced. So they were the first country to introduce their beneficial ownership regime, or certainly a meaningful one. And we're seeing that a lot of countries that lag behind are almost the ones that have the weaker AML controls. So I think all of that will, I suppose, evolve at the same time, or I would expect that to be the case, that as and when AML laws are updated, that the other requirements that have since, I suppose, come about or become the norm as such in the more developed countries, or the countries, I suppose, with the more developed frameworks. So we can expect to see that some of the countries in the MENA region will start to introduce their registers as well, which will obviously increase transparency in the region and put them on a, maybe not equal, but certainly a more level footing with their regional counterparts.
Great. Well, thank you guys for those regional updates. Would you mind, Kira, going to the next slide? We're going to come on to a number of the questions that have been raised just now, actually, by some of the delegates, but obviously those that were submitted in advance. However, if we could just take a moment, we asked all delegates who were registering for the webinar in advance a number of questions, but we just wanted to highlight the following. One was, how confident are you that if a surprise visitor from a competent authority occurred, that you would be okay? And I find this quite interesting and entertaining myself, but I'll come back to you on that point. And then the other one was, you know, what is your biggest challenge in facing your organization from a kind of regulatory perspective? So on the potential AML KYC sanctions knock on the door, 13% strongly agreed that they were in a confident state. 33% said they agreed, 23% said they partially disagreed, and 33% said they were unsure. So maybe we would take that one and let's go to the phone. Rachel, what are your thoughts on how confident our delegates are responding to their potential ability to certainly show or communicate to a competent authority that they are in good standing?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, I suppose, that you have a distinction really between strongly agree and agree. I mean, the regulatory response would be you're either compliant or you're not. So, you know, really, I suppose this is probably the level of knowledge that individual respondents have in terms of the policies and procedures that are in place. So, I mean, no one person is going to have insight into to everything and thus be able to comment to that effect. But I suppose what we would expect to see is, and what we do see, I suppose, is that there is a significant number, I suppose, that are unsure and partially disagree. So not necessarily worrying. I think it's more a case that there may not be sufficient knowledge to I suppose, answer the question fully. But it's certainly something that we expect to see is that there is, and I suppose particularly given that there's so many different aspects to a regulatory inspection, if you like, that there may be different areas that there's significant confidence in and other areas that are perceived to be a little bit weaker. So it's something I think that's interesting. And again, as we've seen and we've discussed throughout the hour, I suppose, is that it really depends on what regulator is knocking at the door to conduct the investigation. So certainly if you're subject to both local supervisor requirements and foreign supervisor requirements, then really the goalposts are different. So your level of comfort in terms of how compliant you are may be different.
Okay, thank you. And maybe Laura, I'll come to you in relation to the second question. You know, what are the biggest compliance challenges facing your organizations? And the responses were, just for those who are on the phone and not looking at the screen, 23% said process challenges, 21% said data document collection and client outreach, 21% said budget and resourcing, 21% said technology and implementation. It's almost a very even split in many ways, and 15% said staying on top of regulatory change. So obviously a few multiple selected options, but what are your thoughts in relation to this feedback, Laura?
I think that's somewhat surprising. So staying on top of regulatory change, can't see on the slide here geographically how that's made up, but as I touched on earlier, certainly within the APAC region, local regulators can have a habit of pushing out circulars quickly with no real advance notice, allowing banks a lead-in time to update their policies and procedures, revise their training, and ensure that they're embedded within the overall compliance program and framework. So that is somewhat of a surprise. Other regulatory items do have a longer lead-in time where you may have more time to be prepared, but it's really only when you come up against a regulatory inspection that will tell the tale of how prepared you are. In fact, I think the other areas that have been called out, so not so much a regulatory perspective, but there's certainly topics that we have discussed in detail in other webinars and other sessions with our clients. So certainly I think the second one there, the data doc collection and client outreach, that is a known pain point. So for financial institutions who maybe haven't invested in technology and they may have siloed outdated systems or quite manual, the client could be contacted by 17 different departments over a six-month period looking for the exact same piece of information. So by the tax team, by central ops, by AML, by trading. So allowing seamless integration of that information and one centralized client record will really minimize the pain points there. Process challenges, again, I think they're always going to be a pain point for financial institutions. And there is a movement over the last decade or so towards more lean business processing, which I think is helping here, but that challenge will somewhat exist. Budget and resourcing is always going to be a pain point. Who in the organization is holding the purse strings for whatever you need to invest in, whether that's internal IT build or engaging with external vendors. And technology implementation, so that is not without its challenges, large scale program management, change programs. But staying on top of reg changes is definitely a lot lower than I would be expecting it to be in this area.
Understood and agreed. And Keir, would you like to move to the next slide? But before we go and take some time just to respond, now we have been weaving in the questions that have been submitted into the webinar so far, but I would just like to highlight to anybody who isn't aware that there is an on-demand webinar from Finergo on automating regulatory change and our regulatory rules engine, which goes into that area that Laura was just discussing in great detail. And if you haven't already seen it or engaged with it, just simply visit finergo.com and you can at your time and leisure, go through the many questions that were raised in relation to how that's best achieved. So I'm going to take a question from Asia, which has just come in from a tier one entity based in Singapore. And it's in relation to blacklists and sanctions. So it says, I've seen reference to blacklists and sanctions in my compliance training. Can you explain the difference and which should take priority? And maybe that's a question for you, Rachel.
Yeah, so I suppose if we consider the blacklist, so essentially if we look at the FATF blacklist, so effectively they call out jurisdictions that are perceived to have strategic deficiencies in their AML and CFT regime. So the idea being that such regions are considered to pose a threat to the integrity of the international financial system, and as a result, financial institutions should take that into consideration when determining the risk categorization of customers from such countries. So on an ongoing basis, FATF will monitor the progress of these countries and may add or remove countries from their blacklist. I suppose that's one element of it. And then separately, depending on the institution, you may have what you determine as an internal blacklist. So this is usually internally determined customers or specific customers rather than countries that are considered essentially parties to not conduct business with or conduct transactions with. So depending on, I suppose, the blacklist that you're considering there, but it's most likely the FATF blacklist. And then if you look at sanctions which are imposed by various governments and international bodies such as the UN, and also then you'll have US sanctions. So if your financial institution is in scope for US sanctions, then they have to be complied with, or you may face, I suppose, violation orders and be subject to penalties. So really the sanctions regime would supersede the blacklist, really. So the blacklist will obviously need to be considered in determining your risk categorization and subsequent customer due diligence that's applicable for clients that are originating from blacklisted countries. Whereas if you're subject to sanctions regimes, you need to comply with those, or you will potentially face monetary penalties. I suppose in certain instances, there may be instances of prison terms that are applicable as well.
Thank you. And there's been quite a lot of questions, many in relation to, you know, what should an FI focus on if they're small or large, or what's the number one priority that our, you know, FI should focus on, sorry, financial institution, in relation to which regulations matter most and which challenges matter most. But I think the thread we've discussed on the webinar, and certainly it's very apparent, is in relation to accountability. So I'd like to just move to talk about, you know, how does the senior management regime and or alternatives, and I know, Laura, you've touched on some of the concepts, but maybe you'd go in a little deeper in relation to perhaps the personal accountability, SMR, versus alternatives and differing oaths that may be at play in the market. You know, where does the, what focus should entities be taking around responsibility, and should, and where should it be levied in relation to a banking employee? So would you mind just taking a moment to talk about that, because it certainly will aid many of the questions that have been submitted?
Sure, it's certainly a topical area. It's one that globally regulators are grappling with, and they don't necessarily have a definitive answer on this. But just in terms of some of the differing regimes that you've talked about, the Netherlands, the Dutch banker's oath is well known. So it is more about ethical accountability rather than any regulatory accountability, but it is taken very seriously within the Netherlands. Everyone working in banks does sign up to this. They are sworn in and they are swearing to abide by the ethical practices. It is an idea that had been floated around in the UK some years ago, never really took off the ground. I don't know, was it because it mightn't be taken as seriously within that context? So the senior manager's regime is, I suppose, an alternative, a more stringent variation of that measurement. And really, why there's a move towards this is many regulators feel that the fines, even though they are hefty, that they're not punitive enough, they're not hitting the banks hard enough. Reputational damage has always been called out as one of the major byproducts of this, but I suppose when you look at the amount of fines that are being handed out and the amount of banks who are being caught by this fold, it's almost nearly a safety in numbers approach for the banks. So it's not one bank being singled out if, you know, there's 50 or 60 banks over a 10 or 20 year period. So that's why the individual accountability is being circled back to more and more. But I know one of the questions that we had received in is whether it's enough to keep this at the senior manager level, whether it should apply to every person within an institution. So I suppose it's quite difficult to quantify. I mean, where would you draw the line? Is it every single person coming into the bank, no matter their age, grade, or length of employment? What about the personal liability insurance? What responsibility lies at the bank level versus the employee level, and what support networks are in place for that? Or is it simply a case that it would roll up to a certain level? So while it mightn't be the executive, it could be a middle manager level that they, as the ultimate process owner, should bear some form of responsibility. So not necessarily the most junior member on the team who maybe had been involved in that, but certainly the person who owns and manages the process. We did touch on earlier the statement from the HKMA last March when they were talking about culture being linked to performance. So that's something that's coming through here. So even if the senior executive regime isn't coming down to every employee, should there still be some element where there may be some form of punitive damage for that employee? So if you have a staff member who's been involved in, you know, subsequent audit failings, audit findings, no improvement, or they've been linked to a number of breaches, should this be linked to either some sort of salary reduction or some bonus reduction or bonus removal altogether? So it's an interesting area, and I think it's definitely one that we'll continue to watch over the next while as this regime is being adopted by more and more countries.
Thank you, Laura. And I know we have actually got about another 20 questions which are submitted, and I appreciate we are over the hour. However, I would like us to just touch on this point because it's come out a number of times. So please bear with us if you're on the line from a delegate perspective. But there's been a question raised, and it's kind of dual in relation to its nature. You know, if a bank is outsourced or is relying on a non-banking or non-regulated entity to support a part of its KYC AML processes, you know, what is the risk effectively, or is there a risk in effectively outsourcing that? And I suppose it tied to that is, where does the liability go? No doubt. So I think that's a question for both of you, but maybe Rachel, you'd like to just feed in on that, and then Laura, if you'd like to give your thoughts, and then we'll move to just wrapping up.
Yeah, so I suppose obviously in recent years we're seeing an emergence of technology solutions to help to manage, I suppose, the KYC process, the customer due diligence process. I think the important thing to remember is that in almost all legislative regimes, the ultimate responsibility is retained by the financial institution. So really any outsourcing would need to be managed appropriately by the financial institution. And to ensure that any outsourcing, I suppose, is or any use of third parties is done so appropriately and also sufficiently. So it would be, I suppose, a hand-in-hand process to ensure that third party is acting in accordance with any contract that's been set out and obviously in compliance with legislative requirements. But again, noting that ultimate responsibility is with the financial institution that's subject to supervision. Currently, we don't see, technology solutions and providers under the remit of financial regulators. So again, their concern would be with the financial institution, though they would obviously take into consideration any outsourcing arrangements that are in place.
Yeah, I think there's some very valid points there. Some countries, again, have more prescriptive rules in this space. So I think even if you differentiate between an entity that you're placing reliance upon to conduct your underlying CDD versus a technology provider who's assisting you in that area. So in the US, for example, where you're placing reliance on someone to conduct all or part of the CDD process, there are very strict requirements around who that entity must be. So they must be an entity that is subject to the CIP rule, and they must sign up to annual recertification and that they have an AML program in place and it's subject to testing. But it's definitely an interesting space. I think it's veering more into an ops risk area. So what are the risk requirements around your third party and outsourcing arrangements? So quarterly governance meetings, due diligence, on-site visits, certifications from any entities who may be involved in your process, more in the vendor outsourcing space, and where an entity is subject to an enforcement action. Can they deem the outsourcer to be, I suppose, to draw a comparison to GDPR, as the processor? So while the bank is the controller and they're nearly the data processor, so can there be sub-assignment of any financial penalties that could be recouped from the vendor?